Hello, everyone. This is Dark Journalist. Today we have an exclusive interview with AI synthetic biology researcher Ilana Freeland. Now, Ilana's recent books on chemtrails and the space fence were part of the buildup to her remarkable new book, Geoengineered Transhumanism, a book that can show us the roadmap of the 21st century technology control grid with some deep esoteric connecting the dots. In particular, on the work of Austrian scholar and mystic Rudolf Steiner. Can we break free of the Ahrimanic nightmare? Let's go ask Ilana Freeland. All the stuff that you've been on top of with this was all highly predictive.
Yep.
So it's actually, it must feel almost strange to just move into it, and then, you know, the books become the reality.
Well, not really. I mean, you and I understand the occult side of life, and I definitely was given this as a mission 12 or so years ago. And then I, you know, I met Clifford Carnicom. I mean, everything just... And, you know, even my initials, EMF, I mean, you know, what can I say? So I've always felt the hand of destiny on this, but this is my last one because I pretty much, this is a long book, Daniel. It's a bit unwieldy, but it's because I'm covering such a huge spectrum. And I want everybody to have plenty of opportunity to see the interconnections and how this has all been set up. The environment was set up for exactly what's going on now. So, but it's the last book. I want to do some other writing. I want to do some other things. And I really have. I took it all the way from space and the secret space program and the breakaway civilization down to this genetic alteration going on now. And it's all connected. It's all the same people.
Yeah, I was thinking, it's so interesting, the Steiner work that you've done is like a gigantic prelude to doing all this. But it's with a deeper understanding around the spirit of the technology coming in. And we know that that's written 100 years ago, but it's like reading it. I mean, you know, in the language, even with the translation, it's so like it could be happening today.
Well, it is happening today. I mean, you know, there's the, of course, the famous quote that has been said by, I think, the first two doctors to use it from Steiner were Thomas Cowan and Dietrich Klinghardt. They both referenced Steiner's quote that if you take it, you will no longer think of spiritual things. And I do believe this is it. I've seen enough to believe this is, that it's very possible that that's what's going on and that the soul is being prepared for transhumanism. And I don't know if you know this, I'll just say it right out at the beginning. I found out in the research that there actually is a patent by which anyone, it's made clear that the transhumans, and they are named as transhumans, will not qualify for human rights because they're no longer human. Mm-hmm. So we're on that road now. And of course, Steiner did talk about, I think he thought it was a long way in the future, but a day when humanity would split and we would be going different ways. And I believe we're undergoing that now. Certainly, whether it's family or friends or people you thought you knew who suddenly are doing something like this and you never thought they would. I mean, all of this is sort of a wake-up call to really looking at what being human means.
Right.
I mean, we tend to think of it as a head, two arms, and two legs, but I don't think so. And I was just reading a wonderful quote somebody sent me from a book called, I think it's called Apocalypse Now, a Steiner collection, in which he said in a lecture long, 100 years ago, that many people who are here are not entirely human.
Right.
And so, that this is making some of us anyway, look a little more deeply into what being human means. And for me, of course, being human is a long evolutionary trail we're on as souls. And it has very deeply to do with the qualities that the Greeks put forth thousands of years ago. And, the moral, the sense of beauty, aesthetic of beauty, truth, goodness, humility, forgiveness, all these virtues to me are primarily the human part of us. And then all the appetites and the laziness and the need for consensus, all of these are parts of us that are from the old group soul that is slowly being dragged into the individual soul, is how I would term it.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think this is, the Chinese say bigger the front, the bigger the back. I think this has a very large back, obviously, what we're undergoing now. Mm-hmm. Certainly the Australians know that. But it also, the front is that we're going to have to look more deeply because our comfort and our convenience are being taken from us, and the quality of living in general. So it's forcing our hand. And Steiner also said that that's the one of the purposes of evil, is to push us toward our evolution, our consciousness evolution.
Right. It is. It's this kind of showdown, in a sense. It's the moment that needs to be faced in order to move forward. But it's quite a moment, because we risk, in dealing with that, the kind of, this thing eliminating our spiritual connection.
And so it's a big risk, very big risk.
Yes.
Yes. And given that in America, if you remember, I was raised in an Eastern European community in Detroit, Michigan, 5 square blocks of Eastern Europeans all speaking different languages. Some of the people in my neighborhood speaking English, mostly it was just the children. And we were all the translators of the letters that came in the mail and that sort of thing. Very, very much like old Europe. And I rarely went into what was America with my grandmother. We'd, take 2 buses to get to a garden plot she rented cheaply where she grew all of our food. And then we'd go down to the farmer's market and bring home 2 live chickens, clucking and squawking in her big bag that she carried on the bus. For me, the Eastern Europeans are very earthy, the Slavic, they're Slavs. Yes. And I'm half Slav. And my other half is entirely 100% Scottish, interestingly. So, for me, I have the best of the Celts and the Slavs, I mean, that's why I'm a mystic, but then I have my, U.S. Navy, father's scientist brain, where it's a really good brain, a really good intelligence, IQ, etc. But I really love systems, and I love studying them, and I love elucidating them, and seeing what their weaknesses are, and what they have made of us, and in that way, I think that doing what I'm doing, which is just public knowledge, just trying to put science out there that is not completely intimidating. Though I know a lot of people start reading the books and are very intimidated by the footnotes, They didn't like science in high school, so they don't like science now, kind of thing. But I really maintain that anyone who's here chose to be here now. And this is a technological age. So anything you're going to find for your spiritual quest, for how your relationships are going, all of that has to do with the technology that we're now embedded in. And now it's being embedded in us, right? Through the nanotechnology that we have now been inhaling and eating since, well, at least for two decades, all of that now is with the 5G millimeter waves and the 6G terahertz is being activated and utilized to control us, eavesdrop on our minds, create out of us a genetic hybrid human, from human 1.0 to human 2.0. I mean, this is an era of transition. And I just don't buy. It's kind of like what I've sacrificed, I feel. I don't know if this is true, but when I was a teenager, in the Kennedy coming of age years of the 60s, I wanted to be a great writer. And I read constantly classics and the biographies and autobiographies of great writers and philosophers, and you name it, I was reading it because I knew I had come for greatness and I wanted to be a great writer. Yet, look what I've done now for about 12 years. I've written 3 books on technology. And because that is the challenge of my era, it isn't to have this wonderful fiction that, great writing in that way. It's really to unravel the technology. And I'm not sorry for that because I feel that our destiny, our lives really have, I've always maintained that my life knows more about what I should be doing than I do. Because, I have a lot of ideas and yet I'm told in a way or directed in a way toward what really serves humanity as well as my own destiny. And that's the best. That's the very best. So that's what I've been doing. Two and a half years I worked on this book, and I guess I'm still not done.
You're right.
I'm done writing, though. I'm done writing.
I want to touch on something which has to do with this kind of biofascism aspect that's come to fruition now. It was really in your books in 2014. 2017. Those books had it, and then it's really come now into the public consciousness. So the work was very ahead of its time. You're dealing with a major scientific look and analysis on one hand, and then you understand kind of cosmological aspects on the other hand. When you look at things like the eighth sphere, in Steiner's cosmology, which draws people into an artificial development, mm-hmm. artificial, evolution spiritually, and is controlled by these forces. And then, you mentioned programs like CERN and everything else, attempts to contact other dimensions. I want to go out into that outer reach because I know your new work is starting to go into that place, whereas the first two books, you could say, just like the new book, has a solid scientific basis, but you're including more of the cosmology. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say it, yeah.
Yes. So I would say then, how does the eighth sphere aspect, as identified in Anthroposophy, play into this kind of CERN, drawing people into the virtual realm, and them, as Steiner says, disappearing into this?
I think that certainly the SWS, the sentient world simulation, is part of the eighth sphere. and is, in a way, populating the eight sphere with those members of that we have a human counterpart to still. And then also there are the virtual replications of the people who are receiving the inoculation now, who are now entering, in my opinion, the transhuman sphere. So we basically are going to have two species. One will definitely populate the eight sphere, and it's tempting to people, and admittedly, it's a slippery concept, this eighth sphere, because you want to make it into an actual planet.
Right.
You want to make it into an actual something in space. And if we had the ability to see in the way that we used to many, sometimes thousands of years ago, at least hundreds, you might see something. You might see something. You might see something that is sort of has a plasma semblance to it. Because I think the reason I say this is I remember when Wilhelm Reich was out there with his Cloudbusters and his orgone technology out in the Mojave Desert, taking photos, infrared, with infrared film of these creatures that are in the atmosphere. And they are, and when you look at the photos, Trevor Constable was the one who followed after Reich, and he too was taking pictures out in the Mojave Desert. And that, those are found in his book called The Cosmic Pulse. I used to email with Trevor before he died because I was fascinated by this. They look organic, you see, but you can't see them with the naked eye. They have to have an infrared look, and our vision does not extend into the infrared without instruments. So they were able to take pictures of these big blobby looking things that had little tiny eyes in them, and then there were the long ones that looked like a blimp or a sausage. They saw all kinds of creatures.
I'm reminded of those kind of cigar shaped UFOs.
Yes, yeah. Like that. And so certainly when the UFOs began to happen back in 1947, we'll just go from that date, of course the Navy and Air Force were absolutely obsessed with them because they had by then the technology whereby they could discern it. I mean, radar changed everything.
Right.
In World War II, there was a way to see in a sort of spectrograph that you could get from radar. And then it went to infrared, and then it went to, you know, and who knows how much they have now. So if you think of the eighth sphere as sort of a plasma place that is populated, I'm sure greatly populated by now, not just with humans who aren't quite human anymore or these organic entities, then, you know, you can picture the eighth sphere that way. But my concern is that with the eighth sphere and this ability to make things virtual or even augmented, AR reality, augmented could mean any of that.
Right.
Are they trying to control the death process and the reincarnation process? This is my big concern, really. This makes me lie awake sometimes thinking about it and how they might do it. I read years ago, maybe a decade ago, I read an essay by some psychologists who were working with a woman named Deva at Alice Springs in Australia, which is a huge underground American base. devoted massively to mind control, UFOs, etc.
This is Pine Gap.
Yeah, Pine Ridge. Or no, Pine Gap. Yes, Pine Gap. I always want to say Pine Ridge. Exactly. And what they were doing was they had this this person, Deva, who had been an MK Ultra basically for many years. And in her case, she would lose consciousness, much like this MK Ultra person I'm working with. She would lose consciousness as soon as she went into a horizontal. That's very important, from vertical, which is astral, to horizontal, which is etheric. As soon as she laid down, boom, she's out. And she would have memories of traveling thousands of miles to Pine Gap and into one of these labs down underneath. They would then do things to her astral body. And then she would come back. The astral body would return to her. And the only thing that was different there is she remembered everything. Mm-hmm. And so she would tell the psychologists. And the idea that as early as, that would be the 80s that happened, as early as the 80s, they had the ability to take the astral body out and move it somewhere, because, of course, the astral body doesn't need a jet plane or anything. Just zoop, and you're there. Right. So what are they doing in the eighth sphere to possibly prevent people from dying? Right. Or to maintain their astral body in the eighth sphere for someone else they want to reincarnate, like, you know, maybe Hitler or Stalin or something. And then the other question is, can they prevent you from reincarnating so that you are under the... See, I don't think that just controlling this planet is enough for them. I know that this Kartov, I think his name is Kardashev. Yeah, the Soviet astronomer Nikolai Kardashev. For technological achievement of any space age, you first need to have full spectrum dominance over your planet. Then you need full spectrum dominance over your star and its systems. And then you need full spectrum dominance over the galaxy and its system. So, you know, the plans, that's the secret space program right there.
Yes.
The plans are big. They're very big. And they will require one generation after another. And this is why they're interested in immortality. But what kind of immortality are they thinking of? See, I know they're not thinking of biological immortality. That's not what they're thinking of. They're thinking of an immortality that is more virtual and is more based on AI. And they're willing to pay their humanity for that, absolutely. They look down on being human. They want to be something else. And that's really what Satanism to me is for the top echelon Satanists. They despise humanity. And they want to be machines, I would think, but maybe inorganic life machines. They'll have some aspects of biological life, maybe carbon, maybe protein, not just all silicon, and it'll be in their consciousness, but they'll also be able to have physical experiences, maybe without bodies. So you know, my concern is for humanity, because we depend upon reincarnation in order to keep developing. And so I do not want it taken away. Right. I do not want our astral bodies completely controlled, and therefore we would take away our free will. We must have our free will. And you know, many people are willing to sell their free will very cheap, but not everybody. Not everybody, and it must be defended. And so that's what we're doing now. We're defending with public knowledge. Right, Daniel?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I agree 100%. I'm very interested in this because I think now I reflect back on an Edgar Cayce quote where he says, Armageddon, as it's understood by the mystery schools, is a battle fought between souls leaving from and souls returning to the earth. And it said it's war in the air. And of course, using that kind of cosmic idea of the air, you know, it's in the sky. And this is the cycle. So there's an attempt to prevent the reincarnation of certain individuals. Now, some people don't even believe in reincarnation. So this part of our discussion goes into an interesting, mystery school concept. But if you think of it from anthroposophy or the Steiner work and theosophy, then we're getting into something very different because you're right. If they have the ability, for example, to hunt down the Dalai Lama's reincarnation, and we know that Steiner had said that the mystery groups were very aware on both sides, the right-hand side and the left-hand side of Blavatsky's incarnation. They expected her to come in. So they have the ability to track these things.
Oh, absolutely. But I mean, that is the key, isn't it? I mean, if people don't, it isn't that I believe in reincarnation, as long as you bring that up. Mm-hmm. It's that, you know, my first experience of a previous life was when I was about 8 years old. And I didn't know what the experience was. I didn't really understand it. I just knew that I read the Allegory of the Cave, written by Plato, and that I immediately knew I had known him. And I didn't say anything to anyone because, well, you know, I was a child. I didn't know that this guy lived 2,000 years ago or 2,500 years ago. I just knew I had known him. And years later, I remembered that experience. And then I began to ponder it. And for me, the turning point was that, you know, my idea of a benign God that is everywhere, pretty much, was that you couldn't just be given 70 or 80 years to develop the kind of consciousness that you would need in order to be a true human being.
Yeah, right.
It just didn't make any sense, especially in my incarnation this time. It took me 45 years to finally get started. Mm-hmm. Because I had a lot of old stuff that I had to grapple with. And for many of those years, I wasn't conscious of it. Mm-hmm. I had to find it. So we're kind of left on our own here to just struggle through. And you know, and many of us never get that far. So if somehow the AI system that now understands humans will never be human. The AI knows it will never be human. It will never have the capacities we have. But it might settle for control over humans.
Right.
And in which case, perhaps over the astral body as well, because the physical and etheric remain here when we die, and the astral goes. So right. If they can control that, then they will control the death process, and they therefore will control the reincarnation process. And I wonder if that is what Cayce was referring to. Makes sense to me. Plus, it reminds me of Steiner saying that in 1879, the Archangel Michael had that big fight going on up in space and then cast the dragon down to the earth. Doesn't sound like he did us much of a favor, but he was able to therefore save the divine realm. So that's, you know, that's a story that Steiner tells. And it does make me wonder if certainly we are dealing with the dragon. And I always think the Chinese always saw the dragon, the good dragons, the luck dragons. But we pretty much see the dark dragon.
Yeah, or it's the Arthurian dragon that needs to be slayed, right? It's the monster.
Or tamed, yeah. Steiner says not to slay the dragon, because of course you're dealing with the double, right? And we all have a double. And if we slay our double, that's exactly what I thought of when I recently, well, not recently anymore, but I saw David Lynch's second round of Twin Peaks, which, Daniel, if you have not seen that, you really must.
I have seen some of it, yes. Very.
Oh, yeah. Because in there, Cooper is separated from his double.
Right.
And what happens is the double, now having no balance in its humanity, becomes just destructive, totally destructive. Whereas Cooper, the real Cooper, without his double, is sort of spineless and like a baby and has no understanding of what anything means. I thought that that was so brilliant of Lynch, and I thought, I think he's Red Steiner. I think he's...
Oh, yeah. They mentioned the Dweller of the Threshold in Twin Peaks.
And the Dweller of the Threshold.
There's the big dead giveaway.
Yeah.
Well, here's what's interesting to me with all the stuff that you're doing. And there's so many things for us to get into that I know what we're going to have to do is also do a live show with you where you can take some questions from the audience as well, because there's so many things that are going to come out of this. I can already feel the wave of questions coming in. But what I'm thinking is, now, one of the brilliant things that I think you're bringing forward with the book is you're saying it's happening now. It's no longer theoretical. We're in it. And therefore, when you look at, you know, people understand in a great way, especially people who read your material, they'll understand the economic life, the political life have been captured. And the media has been captured. How would you see this split happening? How are these people who want a more spiritual manifestation, want actual freedom and civilization, things that are guaranteed in the Constitution, things that were brought through really with that American Revolution and then the developments that we've had, how can those people find each other, and what kind of a world can they build when all of these different systems are captured?
One of the things that I think Steiner taught me was that thinking is a spiritual activity. And for a lot of people who've been conditioned by certainly the American school system, and I would have to throw in the British school system. I've lived in England, I've lived here. I know that both of them have this sort of idea of the intellect as something that some people are good at and some people aren't. And the idea that your thinking could actually be a ticket to consciousness and not just a career or to impress people with how smart you are or whatever, is something that most people miss. And so even with the unvaccinated, so-called, the people who choose not to be transhuman, will they understand that? I mean, I think where they begin to see this is when I hear a lot of people who's saying, there's just no one to talk to. There's no dialogue. There's no opportunity for a real conversation. Everybody's either glued to their iPhone or sort of automaton, not really very present. So we all see what a lack of true thinking can do to a culture, and how it gets very lonely if you can think. I can vouch for that, but also that you don't have anyone to spar with and maybe correct where you're wrong and you know, and in a goodwill way. Instead, what we have now is the reactions of mind controlled people. Truthfully, where you bring up a word like Trump, and suddenly people just come unglued, It's like it's the corollary to bumper sticker politics to me. Is a word. It's like a trigger word. You've been programmed. That's what programming is like. Is you operate, you react, you respond, you come up to have something like a feeling out of this torpor that you're now in by this trigger word. And so, you can't have a culture survive very long on that. It will collapse. And then if we look at that and really sort of put together our observations, those of us who are still human, we put together our observations, we need to think about that very closely, about what education really is, that it's not for the almighty career, that it's not for the almighty dollar, that it actually is for the culture itself, the cultus of the people, so that they can grow, so that the evolution of humanity can move ahead instead of being sabotaged right and left by too much technology, electromagnetics that gives you brain cancer, all these things that we have just let go because we've been lied to and bought the lies, at least a lot of people have, for so long. So how would we, that you're reminding me of the essay I wrote for a book that came out of what I want. I think it was put out by Harry Blaser. Catherine Austin Fitz did an essay in it. I think John Rappaport did, and I can't remember the rest of the people.
Oh, yes.
All really cool people.
Yeah.
And Harry put that together. And in that, I wrote a story about when it all had collapsed. And I think I called it What Would Solon Have Done? And Solon was the Greek guy who traveled through Egypt and the Middle East in order to asking what was the really great culture? What does it take to have a really great culture? And in that way, in this story, they're all starting over. And so what are we going to have to look at? What are we going to have to set up ourselves if we have to start over? I'm always hounded by that in the Sub Rosa America series. I'm hounded by that there too. It's all collapsing. Well, okay, it's collapsing. So we're going to start over. So I don't know if I feel that way now, but I have for a long time. And then to me, it's the conversation that we have. Once we realize that it's collapsing, we're going to have some serious conversations. And we're going to have to undo our conditioning first of what making things happen means. Because it doesn't mean what was. And again, I love that phrase that I use in this book, and I obeyed it, or I tried to. And it is, it's attributed to Einstein, but it is an Einstein. We cannot solve our problems with the same thinking we used when we created them.
Yes.
That's the problem, Daniel, is the conditioning. It's sort of like an invisible mindset that we're in. And we don't even know it's there. We're so used to it.
Mm-hmm.
But we would need to dismantle that. It would be like a big therapy session or something where we would have to be ruthlessly honest with ourselves instead of all these judgments that people have. I mean, name calling, judgments, you know, it's just rife in America now and has been for decades.
Now, Ilana, the title of your new book is Geoengineered Transhumanism.
Mm-hmm.
And the synthetic biology is inherent in that. Can you explain what synthetic biology is?
Yeah, well, the actual title of the book, you need the second title. I'm known for long titles, right? Geoengineered Transhumanism, How the Environment Has Been Weaponized by Chemicals, Electromagnetics, and Nanotechnology for Synthetic Biology. And really, synthetic biology, as happens in this scientism world, I mean, I don't think we we see real science very much. What we see is scientism that is controlling how science is used. And I explain that in a portion of the book, which looks at mindsets. I have an appendix called Mindsets. It's important to read that, perhaps even at the very beginning of the book, because then you will understand the influences that are penetrating the science of our day. So the synthetic biology, they're going to try to narrow that term to make it sound like it simply is about this little narrow area of changing the genetics of so that there can be less disease in the world. You know, they always make it sound very flowery and very beneficent, and really, meanwhile, they're weaponizing everything under the sun, and even the sun. So that's what I go toward in the book. I start out with the usual 100 pages or so of a catch-up on the geoengineering going on that we recognize as geoengineering. And then we begin to look at the smart city setup, which has the hospitals that are now high-tech hospitals of experimentation, and you know, basically sort of Nazi death camps as well. And then I go on to, and all that while I've been explaining various things that are going on electromagnetically and through the chemicals to draw us into the snare of the, what I call the last book, The Space Fence, which is, I like that term best because it's more comprehensive, but for people who don't know what that means, it's the smart grid. And we are now living in a wireless world. And with the nanotechnology in us that also came from the jets, from the genetically modified foods that most people eat, I eat organically, except when I eat out. Then those two things really have made it so that those nanobots inside of us, and all a nanobot is a nanorobot, which has a very, very tiny, tiny microcomputer in it, whereby they can transmit and receive. Nanotechnology is really the very linchpin they needed. They had everything ready in the environment. And nanotechnology actually appeared, Eric Dressler, the founder of nanotech, he was, as a student, as a grad student in the 70s, he was thinking about this and doing a lot of research on it. But he didn't loose the cat from the bag right away because he saw the danger of the technology. And he didn't really know what to do about that because his vision was we could use nanotechnology to build all these buildings and build everything that we need and replace everything we need, and we'd all have leisure time and we could develop our humanity much better. That was his idealistic, and I think he wasn't being duplicitous. I think this genuinely was his idea because, again, he was living in the 70s as a grad student. So he basically was kind of a 60s person. And a lot of us had these ideas naturally. I call my generation the Renaissance generation because we had great ideas and great skills, and we had real ideals. Which were antithetical to the buildup of the corporate control world and the CIA and COINTELPRO and the assassination of our three heroes, whom I call the Three Kings. We had our work cut out for us to bring those ideals that we all had when we lived together you know, I lived in several communes, and we had our own gardens. We lived on very little money. We didn't really need money. We worked things out as groups. We had that ability, and I think Eric had that drive in him as well. But eventually it was, of course, you know, the military keeps track of all graduate programs and money and everything. And so the cat was loose from the bag. The military scooped the cat up. By 1990, we had full-scale nanotechnology going on. That could give birth then to the synthetic biology, because synthetic biology means that it's not necessarily alive, basically. It's biology, but it's digital biology, not molecular biology. So when I first started studying this stuff, I was kind of shocked. Biology was my second major in my undergrad days. And when I met Clifford Carnicum and we're kind of looking under his microscope and things, I eventually found out that a lot of my understanding of biology from college was really not what was going on at all. What was happening was it was all being digitized, so that you could actually create, you could take a virus and do what we now know the term gain of function. You could perform a gain of function on it so that you could get around that clause in some of the laws attempting to protect humanity and protect life that said that you can't patent life. So by doing a gain of function on it, then they were able to eventually patent life processes. And then when they began to kind of cross over genetically and digitally, a lot of these tiny world, I call it, we entered a period in which you can find patents for inorganic life. And inorganic life would very well describe the nano swarms that we have in our bodies, in the environment, you can't see them, in our products that we buy, like women's cosmetics and things like that, toothpaste. There's all kinds of uses for nano-sized entities because, and in many cases, they want those because they swarm. And what swarm means to me is, if you read enough about it, and you you know, even from people who don't necessarily understand what it is, you can see that there's a consciousness in this swarm. And that's where I talk about nanotechnology, in the sense that it is by being on an atomic level, an atomistic level, it abuts the realm of quantum realities, parallel dimensions, however you want to say it. And so the nano bot or the nanotechnology has been contrived to be conscious and to obey its masters at a remote distance. They can be programmed. And you don't need to program all of them. You just program the primaries of the tip of the spear, and they will perform. And I think, Daniel, one of the best places I saw that, when I realized what they could do in the body, was when the California fires were going on, and particularly the Paradise Fire. And you see this drone footage. We all remember it. You know, you're looking at devastation of some houses, but not others.
Yeah.
And you're looking at nearby, there's trees and they're fine. They're maybe a little scorched, but not incinerated at all. That we're not looking at a forest fire. We're not, you know, a wildfire, as the controlled media called it. No, we're looking at something where some choices were made. And that would, then the other thing I saw, and I think it was just someone's iPhone camera, was the phalanxes of what looked like embers in the wind, but they were going in a very sort of marching like Roman phalanx way down highways en route to their next assignment. And I suddenly realized I was looking at nanobots and that they were being directed by someone somewhere, probably with a laptop and a monitor, and that they were being used to immolate preferentially, not as a wild natural fire. So these things, you see the chemicals are coming down, barium, strontium, aluminum, etc. And we're breathing all those because they're all on a nano scale, and a nano is 1/1,000,000,000th of a meter. You could never see it if they didn't swarm. But you can see the swarms without a microscope if you know what you're looking at, such as the California fires. And then, you know, you have the electromagnetism, which is essential for controlling the weather. And as I've said before, I'll say it again, all the weather is controlled. There is no natural weather now other than when it comes up off the South Pacific and is immediately grabbed up by the geoengineers and the U.S. Navy and others to create weather for the entire CONUS, continental United States and Canada and Mexico, et cetera. So weather is one thing from geoengineering, and most people, when they hear the word geoengineer, they think weather. But no, it's much broader than that. And remember, I name everywhere the seven operations of geoengineering, which do get right down to biology, and that's basically, you know, that was my map through this book as well, to get to the synthetic biology that requires plugging us in to the pre-prepared environment that has been absolutely weaponized, in the sense that it can turn everything to a profit, for one thing, and everyone, and then for the change of who really runs this planet and who runs the humans on it. So that's pretty much on its way.
Wow, fascinating information, Alana. Let's go ahead here and do part two with a deep dive on the implications of your incredible findings. Now, everyone can find your work at ilanafreeland.com, and the new book, Geoengineered Transhumanism, that is going to be available coming up here in October. Remember to go to darkjournalist.com to sign up for our newsletter, and don't miss any of the exciting shows that we have coming up for you. We'll be back next Friday with a new episode of the X Series. See you soon.